Welcome to the Guardian Book Club. My name's John Mullen, and I'm here talking to Douglas Copeland about his novel Generation X. I wanted to start by asking you whether it's true that when you wrote Generation X, you were not supposed to be writing a novel, is that right? That you were supposed to be writing a kind of cultural stroke sociological...
Early 1989, and it had been presented to St. Martin's Press, New York, and everyone there is like dead or long gone, so we're talking about ghosts at this point. The word I think that works best with English is like the Sloan Ranger's Handbook, which I've never seen. And so Peter Livingston, who was then my agent, he's long gone, he sold it to the Canadians, the Americans, and I don't think the Brits at that point. And he used the word handbook. And but at the same time, I'm getting older. I'm in my late 20s, and things are finally clicking together in a lot of ways. And I thought, I can't write a handbook. I mean, like, it's like, it's not going to happen. And if I'm going to write, it has to be fiction. So, yeah, and the advance was $22,500.
That's honest of you to...
Which, you know, it's not much money now, and it wasn't much back then. I mean, it could keep you going for not even a year. But again, and the thing about book advances in general is that when you get an advance, all it does is buy you more time until the next book. I mean, it's not like you're out there kind of, woohoo, you know, with Catherine Zeta-Jones, like making champagne pyramids out of flutes or something. And so I wrote this, and I had, I think in retrospect, foolishly, perhaps brilliantly, I don't know what, taken out a lease on a place in California in the Coachella Valley, in what's technically part of Palm Springs. And the thing about leases in California, if you break them, you might as well like, wear an orange jumpsuit the rest of your life. And like, I was stuck in this place. And I had this lease, and I was the only person under between 20 and 30 in the entire valley. And this is before Palm Springs was hip or gay or retro or, you know, just cheap real estate for people who lived in Riverside County. It was just this time capsule that had been under a glass jar, which actually in a weird way made for, I think, the wonder of the book that I was in such an extreme situation. And so there I was, like, okay, they gave me the money. I'm stuck in this scary lease in a scary place, and I've got to write this book, and it's going to be fiction. And it's just one great big, here we go. And that's how it came about.
I know, you didn't want to do a handbook, but I guess it has kind of some of the elements of that left in it, in a way, doesn't it? So yeah. That, for instance, Doug's editors just told me, which I didn't know, that in the original hardback edition, it was down the side panels of the book, the annotations. But definitely there are a few of these which I... Café minimalism. You know what that one is? To espouse a philosophy of minimalism without actually putting into practice any of its tenets.
Yeah.
Which I certainly recognise in myself, and the one I've got at the moment, but perhaps, I don't know if this is supposed to mainly apply to people in their 20s, option paralysis. The tendency, when given unlimited choices, to make none. Did you put those onto the story afterwards, or were they there before?
No, they were created directly alongside. And I kind of knew it as I was doing them that there was no way that they could be organically incorporated into the narrative. And yet they still had to be there, which I guess is postmodern or yeah. Whatever. You've seen The Producers with the movie. And Springtime for Hitler, the musical, opens. And like they're doing the big chorus number with the swastika. And they show the people in the audience, and they're basically like... There's this moment in New York Publishing where the manuscript arrived with these things attached, and it was like the Springtime for Hitler moment, and they're like, oh my God. And the Canadians, they just caved in and said, sorry, we're not publishing it, goodbye, click. Well, thanks guys, that was really supportive. And then the book wasn't originally published in March 1991. It was to have come out in October 90, and it was to have been killed, except God bless them, the kids and the younger staff at St. Martin said, no, you've really got to do this book. You've got to do this book. And so, and I'll never know the names of these people, but they saved my life, really.
It is funny, I suppose, when the book is was lauded for being, you know, of its moment or of its time.
Lauded? It got shat upon.
Lauded, okay. So it's only retrospectively. At the time, nobody...
I think the way Time is rewriting it is, like, it came out and it was this huge instant success, and like Cher pulled up in the limo to my house or something. No, it was this uphill battle, and it's still an uphill battle. You had the big chill generation, like we stopped Vietnam, and we, and just go on and on about themselves, and like, and it's just saying, like, you know what? No, I don't, tell me I'm part of you, because I have nothing to do with you. Don't make me part of your party. And it was like the dog farted. It was just, they couldn't believe that someone was didn't want to be part of their party. And it traumatized a lot of, you know, reviewers of a certain age. And then the only way they could really get back at me or the ideas that were presented in the book were sort of taking pot shots at it. So to say that it was lauded, oh my God, no. You're flipping the pages here. I haven't looked at this book in 18 years deliberately because... I mean, the reason you go back to your family Christmas dinner, Thanksgiving dinner, is because everyone knows exactly what they're not supposed to talk about. So there's a comfort that comes with that. And for me, I look back at the book and it's still too raw, still. And even you're talking about cafe minimalism. Inside my body, I'm like congealing. Like, oh boy, I remember right the day I wrote that. I remember everything about it. Yeah.
I wanted to ask you about some really sort of little things,
okay,
which were the things which sort of I like most about it, I suppose. There's lots of smells in the novel. I don't know if you're conscious of this. There's lots of smells. I remember there's a bit, for instance, where youth really is, as Deirdre says, a sad evocative perfume built of many stray smells. The perfume of my youth, a pungent blend of new basketballs, Zamboni scrapings, and stereo wiring overheated from playing too many Supertramp albums. But it's the stereo wiring overheated, I think I can smell that. I can remember that. It's from playing too many Supertramp albums. I suppose I like that because it suggests that if you play too much Led Zeppelin, it'd be a slightly different smell, maybe.
You have to remember, John, I haven't heard these words or read them in 18 years.
I know.
And
it's unfair.
And they're coming. No, it's wonderful. And I'm like, dang, I'm glad I wrote that. Okay.
Yeah, no, well, I love the smells. And the other thing I wanted to unfairly thrust at you as points of details, as I love the similes, which seem to kind of quite often kind of almost be like little mini stories of their own. Dag is talking about his boss, Martin. He says he's something about, he never gets jokes, and he's got something scared and mean at the core of his existence.
Yeah.
And then you say, like an underfed chihuahua baring its teeny fangs and waiting to have its face kicked in. Or like a glass of milk sloshed on top of the violent filaments of a bug barbecue. And I'm sort of a bit like one or two of the smells. I sort of think I get it, but it's way out of my experience.
I'm not classically trained in writing. I don't have a literary education. And the way I look at the world is more or less molded by art school. And the thing about art school, it's not just about mixing blue and yellow to make green. It's a way of... You learn how to look at the world without being unafraid. You learn how to look at the world symbolically, metaphorically, theoretically, analytically. And I think when I came into writing this book here, and still when I write, I think because I don't have any voices in my head saying, no, you can't do that, I'll just go ahead and do it. And it doesn't always work. I mean, I'll admit that. I've always felt like a Martian within the world of writing. Never inadequate, but always kind of a Martian, because you go to these events and people talk about this and that in a certain way. And like, who are you people? Like, and And I don't think I'll ever sort of mix with them. My friends do tend to be almost entirely in the visual community, the design world, architecture, the entire sort of what's called visual culture. And I think that is reflected in the way I write. Can I just look through this at random?
Yeah.
Especially the middle part, because... Oh, dear God. The thing is, when you look through a book...
I think the descriptions is one of the greatest pleasures of the book.
When you look at a book, all I remember is the way I felt the day I wrote it. All I remember is what was going through my life that day. And the actual content is sort of secondary, just like the emotional memory that comes with... Oh, God, I haven't seen that paragraph in 18 years. It's just so strange.
Maybe I should stop right now and just say that it's time for any of you who'd like to say something or ask Doug anything you like about the book or any of his other books if you want. Yes, okay. Please. Sorry, can you? Okay. I know it's a pain. Thank you.
This isn't a pre-rehearsed question or anything, but I picked up on the fact that when you're looking at this book, you're saying, oh, God, I can remember what happened on that day and so on. Mm-hmm. And the obvious question, if I was sitting in your seat, would be to say, you know, do you keep a diary? And when you're almost reading this book, or if you were to read it, would it almost work as a diary for you? To be able to pull up particular events and things that have influenced your writing?
No, I don't think so, because when you're writing, sometimes you're not even sure why you're writing it, only that you probably need, you have to, and sometimes the overall meaning of it might never become apparent. I don't know. Just to say, like, woke up, you know, went there, did that, came home. That there would be nothing eternal about that, but to have the characters do what they do or how they do it, that is like, that I remember. And I think that creates resonance in any work.
Yeah. Hello. I was just wondering if, when you came to write this book, and it's 18 years ago, so it's a long time ago, but was there any particular objective in why you particularly chose this subject to write about?
There was a definite way of looking at the world, as well as all the emotions that came with it, that was just blank. It was never alluded to or mentioned anywhere. And I really thought, I mean, by then I was getting close to 30, and, you know, you're no spring chicken anymore, and the decisions you make have way longer ramifications than when you're in your 20s and you can sort of bounce around. And it was sort of a deal I made with myself that, well, you either go the whole hog and you do it completely, or, you know, you sell real estate. And it worked out. And again, it wasn't like an overnight thing, but I'm just so glad that I wasn't crazy, that there were other people out there that felt the same way. And for me, the satisfaction of the book was sort of, even tonight, looking at all of you, it's like, oh, I wasn't crazy. Thank you, God, you're here. So that's what I was looking for. If you're writing a book to get famous or something, it doesn't work that way. I don't think there's any way to really cynically write a book except a cookbook. I don't think you can write books cynically. And I think... And one of the greatest misconceptions about me is, like, by pure accident, I have really awesome timing. Like, Microsurfs, which I began in 93, which was, talking to New York especially, I remember the phone calls, like, micro who and micro what? And what do they make, software? What software? I mean, and New York, believe it or not, is really, it's like 3 or 4 years behind everything. They're so slow to catch on there. So, like, you know, I took, like, I think I got a smaller advance for that than I did for X. And then when it came out, it was the week of Windows 95, and it was like, woo, masterstroke, and, like, no. So you can have luck, and you can have, you know, hard work and training, but you can't master plan that kind of thing. Yeah.
When you were over doing JPod, we came to see a reading, and you closed with a comment that you wouldn't be doing these things anymore, these type of events.
I knew you would be here.
Sorry. So what changed, and what caused that comment, and then what changed for you to come again and talk about Generation X?
To you it's one question, to me it's like 50, and I'm trying to disentangle them in my head right now as we speak. I had, and I'm not there yet, I've got to learn how to come to grips with my past. I've tried ignoring it, I've tried being flippant, I've tried being ironic, I've tried like just flat out denial. I've got to come to terms with it because it's really screwing me up. And I mean, I've in 18 years, I've made, read maybe 3 reviews of any of my books total. I won't read about myself, good or bad. Sometimes people say, okay, here's something really juicy, just listen to this one sentence. But I can't handle myself. And especially with JPod, that was the end of a certain way of looking at publishing, where the author is put out. You're doing 400 cities, and you'll eat crap food for this time, and like you'll just feel like a used napkin at the end of it all. And part of saying I wasn't going to come back was just saying I can't do that way of publishing anymore, and which is good timing because publishing is now different. There's the internet. I don't know if anyone here is twittering or whatever, or blogging, but there's not so much importance on physicality anymore. And so if you're going to do something, it might as well be something that's really good, something that counts. Because there was like the paranoid emails, like, I'm not going out and talking about Generation. This is like crazy. It's like, no, do it. Because, you know, I don't know if it feels healing, but just being able to talk about things like this, I'm getting somewhere. I still can't read it. And so, I mean, yeah, the changes in myself and changes in publishing, I think, are responsible for that.
Hello. As a psychologist, I've just been really interested in, I've been picking out the things that you've been saying about how the brain works and the stuff about memories, the stuff about people not understanding metaphor, and, you know, kind of referring it all to kind of information that I know. How much are you interested in the kind of current leading edge psychological theories?
There's this new book, Generation A, which is currently in your bookseller stands. I began writing this book around the same time I began writing a biography of Marshall McLuhan, who's this sort of Canadian media prophet from the 60s who fell into obscurity in the 70s, died in 1980. And the thing about him is that I'd never studied his work back in the day because I was too young, and by the time I got to art school, other theories were in vogue. He was just this medical disaster. When he was alive, people were still performing lobotomies. There were no CAT scans or MRI scans. There was no SSRI. There was just nothing. The brain was kind of this big, gooey smoothie inside your head that no one really knew how it worked. And he had stroke. Everyone in his family died of strokes. He had mini strokes. He had pediemal seizures. He was very, very sort of like, you would call it Asperger's now, like certain kinds of behavior exhibited. You know, the medium is the message. Like, you know, if I just sat down in a chair and, you know, had a brandy and thought about it, I could have had that idea too. But like, no, you had to have every single experience you've had in a certain row. And even then you have to wait for like lady luck to like, you know, ring the doorbell. I think we're very close to coming to a lot of really major understandings about where emotion comes from, where everything comes from. And I don't want people to think that I'm sort of that in any way negates the soul, or that in any way negates the sense of self or genius or wonder or like stupidity or whatever. It's just, it's all part of us. And I think we're all going to have to recalibrate the way we look at personality and the way we look at creativity, especially. And I mean, if you're a psychologist, I mean, can I ask you, do you think we're sort of heading in that direction? Is that?
I certainly do, from the discipline that I come from, which is a human givens psychologist, psychotherapist, and absolutely an understanding that there's an observer self that is separate, that the consciousness is separate, and that is looking at the individual.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I think it's the next wave, and you know, so I'm writing something about it right now, and maybe I've got really good timing. maybe not.
It's very interesting stuff.
But yeah, I mean, you can only be fascinated in things. Then you can write in them. If you're not fascinated about something, don't try. Don't bother. Yeah. Great question. Thank you.
Hi. The decisions that they make at the end of Generation X, I think I'm thinking of the right book. Is that something that you kind of fantasized about doing, or did you think about what happened to them afterwards and what they went on to do.
What decisions do you? You mean going to Mexico?
The escaping, yeah, the escaping from their what their futures would have been if they'd stayed in. Sorry.
No. I'm feeling. When you write a book, you spend this enormous chunk of your life, maybe a year and a half, and these people are part of you. They are you. I mean, you made them. And you live with them, and you learn to know everything about them, and you get mad at them, and you love them, and then you write the end. And it's a death of sorts, it really is. And I hope they're happy. That's all I can say. Yeah.
I just wondered if you'd be willing to say something about your writing process, about how what your lifestyle is like around planning and writing and revising.
When I meet other writers at writers' festivals or something like that, that's the one thing everyone discusses. And one thing we all come to realize is that we're like, you have to be like fantastically routine-oriented to get through long-form fiction. You have to say no to things. You have to like be willing to be bored. But you have to be in that same position every time, every day. It's strangely lonely. I mean, I live in suburbia, and like the day will go by and all I see are the squirrels and the blue jays, and I mean, a few things come to mind. Most people start out as night owls, but then they become early birds or they become morning riders almost invariably. And I'm not like I get up early, but I now do all my conceptual, I conceive things in the morning, and then the rest of the day is spent doing other things, editing. I have a friend here in the audience tonight who's also a writer, and he's writing a novel. And I was sort of privileged to see sort of his creative process, and he's got these huge like charts and graphs and post-it notes, and it's just terrifying. And I just came away from it feeling so inadequate because like I have nothing, and I go from like A to Z in just one direction, and. And I hope the idea works. I know it has to happen along the way. And there's very little by way of notes or paper trail at the end of it. So everyone is different in that sense, but when it comes to time and your day, the structure of your day has to be the same for everyone. Mordecai Richler is a well-known Canadian writer. Some of you here might know of him. He said that when he meets people at events, and what do? Like, I'm a writer. Oh, when do you write? Like, whenever the spirit moves me. And he thinks, like, hack. It's like, and it's true. It's a discipline. Yeah.
You referenced Obama earlier in your speech, and you mentioned that you were born in the same year. How much of his vision of his past do you think you share, and how much of your joint vision of the future do you think you might share?
Great question. Thank you for asking. I think he's fantastic. The thing about Obama is like also he's from Hawaii. And I used to go to school there. Like no one's from Hawaii. So I'm kind of like proud of Oahu for like having done that. I mean, the other part of it too is like I'm from Canada. Being Canadian was sort of like being like American light or American, like slightly different. And then around 2000, like kaboom, like they went off into their own hyperspace and we went off in our own direction. And it feels like we have nothing in common with the country anymore. And I mean, they're our neighbors. We want to like them. Why wouldn't you want to like them? And it just, especially through the last 8 years, it was just a nightmare. And so finally, with Obama being elected, it was like to enjoy being close to our neighbor again. And then I think the thing about the American elections is when the results come in, it's about 5 a.m. over here. And so I mean, only the true diehards stay up to see the results when they come in. But I mean, I'm in Vancouver, which is a West Coast time zone, and technically they can't call an election until the results come in from California, Oregon, and Washington. And I mean, I think we'd all been kind of flippant about, oh, the election results, haha. But around 7:30, just everyone stopped talking. And then at 8:01, sort of like the victory came in. And I don't think we expected to feel the way we felt. It was just amazing. Then he came in and he said, you know, everyone, you know, like black, white, Hispanic, gay or straight, disabled, abled or whatever, you're all in. And like, I mean, this is like a president who uses like talks about gay and straight in his speech. It's like, wow. He's like finally of the times. He's like lives in the same universe. He talks about Hispanics, you know, like I think Ronald Reagan was president for 8 years and never once said the word Mexico. It's just like you finally have someone in power who like you can share a view of the world with. My other statement is it shouldn't have been Joseph Biden as VP. It should have been Jodie Foster, and she'd be a fantastic vice president. And Jodie, if you're in LA listening to this on podcast, just do it.
How much do you feel that you share with him as a Generation Xer? Do you think of him as a Generation Xer?
No.
Future and present and possibly past.
Well, sort of in an oblique way, that's approaching the whole question. Is like, well, is there a Generation X? And that the other part of the book was that, like, how just like savagely it was like appropriated by advertisers and the military and politicians of all level. Like, how can we use this for short-term advantage? And there's nothing you can do to stop that. It was just kind of ugly, and like sometimes you just got sort of tarred along with the rest of it, and I didn't like that. But what I say is, if you have to apply a psychographic to it, and that's a very sort of sterile marketing term, you know, if you remember the Talking Heads in Depeche Mode and you like them, you're probably X. And like it's almost like that simple. On the other hand, what I like about Barack, I've never met him, my close personal friend Barack, is that he's not stuck in that whole weird baby boom, Forrest Gump, life is a box of chocolates, solipsistic, like we went to Woodstock, kind of like thing. That it is definitely a change in the way, completely change. An overall change in the way people think about the world. And it seems pragmatic, it seems healthy, I don't sense a lot of, you know, people with huge wallets sort of secretly feeding him money. I just feel that it's real and it's genuine with him. Yeah.
Since we're looking back, I'm wondering, you've mentioned a number of times, and you have even this evening, about your kind of emotional relationship or affinity to visual arts culture. You studied originally sculpture, and you continue now to produce artwork in parallel to your writing. Since we're looking back at this book, which was your first novel, which is your first extended piece of writing, I'm wondering if you could maybe tell us something about that transition, because a few years before that you'd had a solo show in Vancouver. Could you maybe say something about that transition from a visual artist to a novelist, a writer, but one who still feels more kinship with visual artists?
I had a visual art career that was actually going pretty well. And then I began, there's that, you know, the Lana Turner wearing a sweater at Schwab's drugstore story where I had sent a friend a postcard and she put it on her, when I was living in Japan, she put it on her fridge and a magazine editor read it and said, you should be writing for us. Phone call came, sure, I'll write something, why not? And
on the basis of a witty postcard.
And
that's a good editor. That's a cool sort of...
Well, yeah, I think she was a good editor. And so I did it, and because I hadn't been through a lit program, I didn't have any getting published. It was just like, sure, an article, okay. And they say, okay, here, stop doing this because it's working against you. And here's the art director. We're going to do something really cool to go with it. And I think I was very lucky. I got used to the whole notion of being published. It just demystified it completely, of working with art directors who I love. And And then there was a sort of magic flipping point, and it occurred outside the Golden Griddle restaurant at the Davisville subway stop in Toronto in October of 88. It was about a month after I quit smoking, November. And I was like, okay, I think, I don't know if everyone has moments like this, or maybe if you do, you get two or three in a lifetime. It's like, okay, you are going to have to change your life. You're going to have to change everything. And again, this is like when you're getting close to 30 and you're no spring chicken. And I'm going to have to write fiction. And I have to put everything visual on hold indefinitely until I get that in order. And, you know, and if you thought you were going to go make any money in, you know, magazine work or advertising or the professions usually associated with words, you know, we'll kiss that goodbye. And it was really, it was hard. It was just like, and for about 10 years, I didn't make anything visual. I thought like, oh, it'll somehow like come at the expense of words or something. And it was, which was an incorrect superstition. And now I do have a regret that I didn't make more visual work back in the 90s. I just much better saying no to things and doing what I really want to do these days. I don't know if that answers your question. Okay.
It does. Thank you.
Thank you.
In a lot of your stories, you use Canadian elements to describe quite rugged things, like the young boy who went out to the prairies on the Greyhound bus that you describe in the very beginning of Generation X. Yet a lot of your stories are actually set in the States, and it was interesting to hear you talk about the States in this frame, because I kind of feel the same. But what's up with the mix between the Canadian and the American elements?
I think with Generation X, I was like, I was there in the States, and in this weird bell jar, screwed up, it's like diorama like version of the States at a certain point in time, and that was sort of half cluelessness, half accidental. I just ended up there, and it was so intense and so overwhelming that it completely colonized that book. The things like since then, 10 of the 12 novels have taken place in Canada. And yet still people ask me, like, why do all your books take place in the States? So I don't know what that's about. They take place in Canada. I don't know why people still say that. It just weirds me out. And like, oh, and because the first book happened in the States, I'm not allowed to become part of CanLit. And I don't know, I mean, three people in the audience know what CanLit is. Who here knows what CanLit is? Two hands in the audience?
Two hands.
Okay. CanLit is the official canon in Canada, whether or not you're allowed to be perceived as Canadian, and between the whole set in Palm Springs thing about Generation X, and the fact, because the Canadian publisher refused to publish it, everyone thinks he wouldn't even want to be published in Canada. It's like, people do nothing except make my life miserable.
So like, you've got to set your novels in Canada.
Well, they have been for 10, and whoever you people are, just stop it. You're like those nasty old ladies who send letters to the newspaper. Just get a life and leave me alone. Thank you. Okay,
well, it's a great, CanLit, get real. That message has gone out on the,
thank you,
on the podcast. That's maybe a resonant way to end. Thanks very much for coming, and I'm sure you'd all want me to thank Doug very much for coming and talking to us.
Thank you, Doug.
Sorry.